This is the Amp Hour Podcast. Released June 7th, 2020. Episode 495. An interview with Eric Klein. Welcome to the Amp Hour. I'm Chris Gamble of Contextual Electronics.
And I'm Eric Klein, partner at Lemnos Labs.
Welcome, Eric. How are you?
I'm good.
It's good to talk to you. Yeah, we're both in lockdown, but we're surviving, and we're going to talk a bit about some venture capital. And so, you know, we've talked about it a little bit in the past on the Amp Hour, but Lemnos is another big company in the space, and you're investing in interesting companies, and I'd love to get your background and how you know, generally, maybe we should start with that. How do you think about hardware in 2020, and what are you excited about?
Well, it's, of course, a very interesting time. You know, when you work in the venture business, you tend to think macro and think micro. So at the macro level, as we're all aware, it's an unprecedented event occurring. And like almost every other business, venture capital is just starting to figure out how to come back to work. For the first part of the crisis, we were just sort of turtled up, for lack of a better phrase, trying to make sure that our existing investments had the capital that they needed to be successful and to try to help them navigate through, you know, this difficult period.
Yeah.
And now we can start to say, all right, let's get back to our job. It's amazing, you know, how much I think we all learn how much, you know, physical interaction or, you know, being together is important to us. It's hard to contemplate investing, you know, $5 or $10 million into a company and into a group of people when you can't, you know, sit down and talk with them.
Right. Right. Yeah. Look them in the eye, get a good feel for who they are. And like, I always hear about, you know, here, I think you have talked about this and other investors talk about, you know, you invest in the person and it's like, yeah, if you can't be across to them, getting a good feel for who they are, how could you develop that picture and trust enough that it's not going to be like, well, $10 million down the hole. And what's the big deal?
Yeah. We always learned one of the things we loved when we invest in an entrepreneur is one of the last things that we do is we go out and have dinner with them. And we just talk about the rest of our lives. And it's a great way to understand the individual you're about ready to go on a, you know, potentially a 5 or 10 year relationship with. So we're just getting back to that point, you know, underneath this difficult time we live in, as a, you know, someone who loves hardware and invests in technology that involves hardware and software brought together, I tell you, it's incredibly exciting. I think the things that we're unlocking right now in terms of new markets and new opportunities is huge. If you go back to Chris Anderson, and you know, he always says that for the longest time we lived in the benefits of the iPhone revolution, right? Where the low-cost SoC, low-cost accelerometer, all the things that we put into smartphones that we, you know, we brought the price down. The same thing is happening today, right? Right now, in terms of robotics, right? The lower as we, you know, massively decrease the cost of things like ESC controllers and battery technology for robotics. And we're opening up markets in the same way. Robots that used to cost, you know, robotic solutions that used to cost $50,000 to $100,000, right? Think about how much LiDAR used to cost, a Velodyne LiDAR puck.
Right.
Now you've got folks working on solutions where they're trying to get that, you know, well under $1,000 and trying to head for $100,000.
Yeah.
All of a sudden we get LiDAR for you, right?
right.
So it's almost always happening. And it's fun to, as a technologist and someone who loves hardware, to go, oh my gosh, now we can incorporate that. What could we do that maybe, you know, we technically could have built before, but we couldn't have done it at a price point that would allowed adoption by the mainstream.
Yeah.
And so I think it's really exciting times.
Yeah, that's great. And so actually, I'm going to make one broad reference here to a Mark Andreessen post that we did talk about and laugh about a little bit on the Amp Hour. But that was actually what interests me. I was like, you know, we really should get someone in VC on here to give us some real talk that is actually doing hardware stuff. You know, so to remind people, Mark's like, oh, we got to build things again. And I'm like, well, some people are building things. And it's like, I had very awkwardly sharp comments about that stuff. But you have been and you are investing in people in hardware. And so what do you see, you know, is there more money going into this space, or is there more interest broadly? I mean, does Mark's comment represent more of the VC industry than what you've seen? I mean, what is your take kind of like from a very high level on the industry and interest in hardware?
I probably have an outspoken opinion on this, and we've been doing it for about 10 years. So I guess we've earned a right to have an opinion at least.
Yeah, right. Well, I mean, you have a Twitter account. Everyone has an opinion on there, right? But
that's all I needed.
I think you actually have some bona fides as well. You know, that's the real thing.
I think when you go all the way back to the beginning of venture capital, you know, it goes all the way back to the 60s, right? And mm-hmm. it invested in Fairchild and Intel, and it started in hardware.
Right.
But
right.
I think as we've entered the modern era of venture capital, I think you see two opposing forces. Number one is venture capital, I think, is much like me, you know, we're excited about the future and we're excited about what you can do with atoms and bits coming together. So I think there's this natural desire to invest in things like, you know, rockets and robotics and all different areas. But I think that natural desire is sort of thwarted or dampened because venture capital, as much as it's designed to take risks, it doesn't like the risks associated with hardware in the sense that a traditional software startup, you know, 60, 70, up to 80% of them, depending on which survey you read, die of natural causes, right?
Mm, yep. Yeah.
Hardware startups are inherently more difficult. We always say hardware is hard. I always say just think of the capital requirements and the fact that in the first 15 employees, you often can represent 8, 9, 10 distinct disciplines that must come together effectively to do a very, you know, difficult thing, which is to bring together hardware and software. They, by their inherent nature, are doing software and then adding hardware on top of it. Mm-hmm. And so there is more risk associated with a hardware startup. Hopefully the returns are commensurate. But I think most venture capitalists, if they, you know, took a look at a software investment with a certain rate of return and a hardware investment with a certain rate of return, they would almost naturally take the software investment because there's less risk.
Yeah. Well, I always talked about margin too. I mean, like, so one thing that when I went from a hardware company to a software company, I just remember there was, you know, like once you buy chairs and nice computers and everything else, it's like, you're not buying parts, you know, like just the pure margin, like the accounting level of like, how much is your cost of goods sold? It's not just people anymore. It's stuff. It's like, you know, and it's, I guess if you equate bits to brain power and atoms to the thing that you have to put together, you know, you need both, like you're talking about, you need both in a hardware startup, and a software startup just doesn't have that whole element on a profit and loss statement.
Yeah, I always quote the very standard line. It comes from the consumer space, but right, I need a software. I need a hardware company in the consumer space to carry a 4x, you know, multiple on their BOM in terms of their selling price just for the math to work. And they're like, oh my gosh, that's a huge markup versus my BOM. I don't understand. And I'm like, yeah, you'll understand as soon as you try to run a hardware business and
exactly, yeah.
and float your inventory and pay for marketing and do all those other things. So, you know, venture capital it assumes and expects that a hardware business can run it at, you know, 70 to 90 points gross margin.
Right.
And that's really, really hard to do early on, right?
Right.
Where your MOQs, you know, your order quantities are low. You're not getting the best pricing yet. You're still figuring out your manufacturing process. You're not shipping huge, you know, crates of, you know, in, you know, shipping container crates, you know, over yet.
Yep. Exactly.
It's hard to do that. So there, I think, unfortunately, it is hard. It is much harder for a hardware startup to attract venture capital and to be successful through the cycle. And I think over the last 10 years, we've seen that, which is a lot more venture capital did try to flow into, especially consumer electronics in the last 10 years.
I was hoping you'd bring up this distinction. Yeah. Because in, you know, you've been talking about robotics and there are some robotics in the consumer space, but like talking about consumer versus industrial or, you know, medical or other non-consumer spaces, how does that end up tracking with the companies that you go and invest in? And does it have to be by definition non-consumer?
Yeah, I think when we started our business, and I came from, if you look at my background, I'm more consumer. I had plenty of enterprise time, but I think some of the things people know me for come from the consumer space. So I knew how to ship consumer hardware. And so when we started 10 years ago, I think probably 30% of our investments were in consumer. Today, I might do 5%. Every once in a while, I'll see something in consumer. But in general, we and many other venture capitalists, at least temporarily, have drifted away from consumer investing because of what happened both in the market and what happened in the overall market for consumer, the changes in terms of the concentration of power. And then I think the other thing is just the death rate.
You're right, right. You might have some really big wins, but or some big acquisitions, but you might not get that many.
Unfortunately, if you look, that's the challenge from venture's perspective. There haven't been the ratio of death to success is so far skewed to failure right now that it really scares venture capitalists away from consumer.
That's interesting. And so, how do you start to make these decisions? So, like you're a partner at Lemnos, you are a big name in the space and stuff like that, but you know, you see these kind of broad macro trends and then that drives your future investing decisions. But like, is it like you kind of develop this thesis and then build upon it later? Or like, how does it end up shifting from a 30% to a 5% over time?
We're always looking to the future. This is one of probably the most exciting parts of my job is I'm always to that point I made earlier, I'm always looking at the intersection of where markets are going and where technology is going. And trying to answer a simple question, you know, what new solutions are going to be opened up in the next, call it 1 to 5 years, where we can, you know, combine some new technologies, combine a change in the market, and a company could come in and change something and create a large business. Mm. I do go back to this example, and I can point out a few others, but I always go back to the example that 3 or 4 years ago, we started looking at the lowered cost of a bunch of components, and we said applied robotics, not the general purpose Jetson, you know, the Jetsons TV show, you know, computer running around, but
Rosie the robot. Yeah,
so not Rosie, but you know, where I could combine an arm, you know, a KUKA arm and I could put a Lincoln Electric TIG welder at the end of it, and I could add a bunch of software and AI and things, and I can make a welding system that acts more like a traditional welder would think and act when it, you know, it's presented with a problem, right? Not a perfect jig, not two perfect parts. You know, how do I weld them together?
Not an assembly line where you have the exact same thing every time, you're saying. It's more of a flexible solution kind of idea.
Yeah, where I'm looking at a quarter inch piece of chrome steel going on to a 3/8 flat steel at a weird angle. And I'm like, I think I could get those two welded together in a pinch. It may, you know, and I'm going to do it the right way, right? Welders take a look at imperfect conditions and make a perfect weld. That's their job.
Right, right.
And I can tell you that, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, those sort of problems, we started to look at advances in, again, computer vision, point cloud generation via LiDAR, and then the fact that arms and stuff were already relatively inexpensive and getting less expensive. And I go, wow, I think we, as an example, we could augment the work that welders do.
Right.
And across the board, robotics was coming into its own. So you say, all right, I'm going to invest more into that space. And okay. You start looking for entrepreneurs and solutions there.
So it sounds like a lot of like Venn diagrams almost of like you have these different things like, oh, crossover. I see it, you know, remix.
That's a great analogy. And you're just looking for more intersection space, right? If you're too early, right, you're, you know, the classic phrase shooting in front of the duck.
I've never heard that one.
It's just the Venn diagrams. There's not enough overlap, right? But you want them to be there and you're trying to push them together. You can't do that. You're venture's job is to not be too far in front and not too far behind. Too far in front, that's R&D, right? That's DARPA and universities and things like that.
What's a recent example of something that you would have been too far in front? Like where maybe you have an external example too of something like a company tried to integrate it, but it was like, it just wasn't there yet.
Oh, I mean, I can give you an example. I was just literally just came off of a call. One of the things that we think a lot about right now, and everyone's trying to guess, are we at the edge of it or not, is the transition from ICE or internal combustion, gasoline, petrol, over to an electric-based infrastructure, right? Sort of the one of the underpinnings of a fourth industrial revolution. We've clearly started down this path, right? You can see the increased investment in renewable energy, solar, wind, starting to kick in and become a predominant source of power. But underneath that, to move that power all the way through the grid to the point where you could, for instance, charge your Honda car or your Tesla or your house, and maybe even bank and store energy at your own home. How we make that conversion and how we build in new pieces of infrastructure and potentially even remove old parts of infrastructure, I think a lot of us in the industry are like, are we 3 years? Are we 5 years? Are we 7 years? I don't think we now believe that it's 20.
Right.
I don't
right,
even think we think it's 10. And so now all of a sudden VC starts to wake up and we go, oh, have we reached the window? And so for some VCs like me who sit farther out on the edge, I'm like, I think it's time to go probably. It might be a little risky, but we got to go.
Yeah. So you start to see people that are coming to you with proposals or pitches and they say, hey, this actually plays in this space. And your ears perk up and you say, oh, okay, this is part of what I'm interested in now. So you might spend more time on it.
So I invested recently in a company called Electrify and it's a software company, but deeply tied to hardware, which is, when you start to have hundreds and thousands of fleet vehicles, you have to manage when and how they charge because they can't all just show up at the 5 charging stations and, you know, sit for an hour and a half. When you have large fleets, you don't just add a charger for every new node.
Yeah, capacity problems.
Capacity problems. And by the way, I've got I have an inrush problem. All of a sudden, if they all ask for power at the same time, I'm asking for more power than potentially big parts of the grid could give you.
Oh, that's, yeah.
And then you have to think about where the load is going. Like, for instance, if it's a bus, where's that bus going? When's the optimal time to charge it so it can have maximum uptime? So it becomes a really interesting math problem. But you can only have this problem when we have enough nodes, enough vehicles that are electric. And by the way, think of this. If the LA County bus fleet was converted to electric, think about how much stored potential energy all of a sudden you have. You create these amazing second order effects. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have to use software and hardware to manage that. So I'm betting that the world is going to start moving over from ICE to electric just because of the cost savings associated with those fleets.
Yeah.
But the timing of it is everything. And so that's what we spend a lot of time doing is, you know, where are areas, have they matured or maybe there's less opportunity for investment or it's become a cold environment, aka consumer. And then there are hot areas where I think, you know, ICE to electric is going to be fundamental and that, you know, it's a great time to be investing in these type of companies.
Yeah. What were those second order effects? So you mentioned that for the buses. What are some of those second order effects you think about with that?
I'll go back to the welding example. So everyone goes, oh my gosh, that means welders are you know, we've sent the robots to take out the welders. Oh no.
Right. They took our derbs. That's South Park.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll tell you two things about that. Today, in the United States, there are over 200,000 open welding positions. The average age of a welder in the United States is 56 years old.
Wow.
20 years ago, you know, we glorified white collar jobs. I mean, I grew up in that era, right? It's, you know, you got to be a banker or a lawyer or a software coder, right? And we took the vocational arts and said that maybe it wasn't the great, you know, the best path. And that has repercussions. 10, 20 years later, those amazing welders who built America and build America every day, there are just less of them because they're getting older and retiring. But we didn't renew because we didn't, in essence, glorify. We didn't honor vocational work. And so now we have this huge gap. This isn't about, you know, welder, you know, robots taking welders' jobs. This is about the fact that Newport News, one of the largest shipbuilders in the United States, can't get enough welders to do the work they need to do.
Right. And you can't just turn that on, you're saying, either, right? You can't just say...
I can't just snap a finger and have 200,000 welders. And then right. If you actually... I was just in Cleveland not too long ago, and I was at a muffler, at a place that makes performance mufflers. And when you actually work with a welder, a lot of the work that they do, there's, what I'm going to call simple welds and complex welds. A welder doesn't wake up in the morning going, I want to run the same, six inch or 12 inch diameter weld 100 times today.
Right.
Right. I've been welding for 20 years. I want to do that weld that's tricky and hard that really requires all of my knowledge as a master welder. So if I can build a robot that can do the simpler welds, it frees that company up to take their master welders to go work on the really hard weld, right? The one that makes that muffler do amazing things because it's a complex, operation.
Right.
And so right now we're still at the stage, robots aren't taking anybody's jobs in the most terrifying way. But they can augment and get rid of a lot of really crappy jobs like washing dishes and picking weeds and doing simple welds repetitively so that we can take our workforce and have them do the things where you've got to use your brain and your brawn to get it done.
Yep. Yep. I always like talking to roboticists, and you always, it's fun to, poke them a little bit and be like, Terminator and they're going to take our jobs and all that other stuff. And the roboticists, they just look at you and like, have you programmed a robot lately? Do yes. you know how hard this is? Like, and it's like, people are trying to make it better, but it's just not easy. There's just a lot of literal moving parts, and it's, there's a lot of programming there and reverse kinematics and all that other crap that goes into it. And it's like, okay, well, maybe it's coming, but it's not there yet.
It's the same thing we talk about AI, right? Right now, if you ask an artificial intelligence expert, we're really doing machine learning. And in essence, primarily, we're doing reinforcement learning. We haven't broken through to the general purpose AI that, achieves, massive levels of human intelligence. And again, that's the point. I think a lot about what we're doing right now is augmentation. Heck, anytime I don't have to do a repetitive, annoying job, I can go off and do something that's far more rewarding and challenging. And that's where we are, I think, with a lot of these new technologies, is we're trying to remove some of the mundane work that we can, augment or automate. So
yeah.
I tend to look for those type of investments. And then again, they're second order effects. This allows that welding company to concentrate its master welders on new business or on more complicated operations so that they can make more money. They're like, look, if I don't have more welders, if I can't do more welds, I can't grow my business.
Yep.
It's not about shrinking, it's about growing. They're like, boy, if I can get a robot to help us grow, I'd gladly do it.
Yeah. I've talked about, I think about automation and like the, one thing I've mentioned recently is like, for my consulting work and what I've been doing is like, I'm not taking someone's job, but basically in the same way, I'm allowing people to grow in that they don't usually have a technician having to go out and push a button to reset something or go measure something out in the field. That's the value proposition of like IoT generally is to remove the need to have a technician going out in the field. That's why it's so popular in industrial, in my opinion. And it's like, it's not taking jobs now, it's maybe taking future jobs, but like you're saying, it's enabling that future higher level thinking that many of the technicians are good at anyways.
No, I liken it, I think a lot of your audience probably engineers. I always liken it to whenever I find a new tool that cuts some process out, right? All of a sudden I get a brand new library. I'm like, I don't have to write that library anymore.
Right. Woo-hoo! Yeah, right. Right.
Exactly. I'll take any small improvement I can, because the amount of work in front of me is nearly infinite. It's just, if I can trim off something that I don't have to do, it just adds one more thing to the queue in front of me.
Right. It's not a value judgment. It's just I want to get better. I want to do these things faster, make more money, like you're saying.
Exactly. So, that's where we are. And that's at some level, the crux of what I think deep tech or frontier tech investors are looking to do is to bring in new processes, new techniques, new technologies to make, businesses go faster, bigger, stronger.
Yeah. So what are some of the other bubbles on your Venn diagram. So you mentioned robotics, and I'd love to hear about some of the companies that you're investing in that are doing robotics, but are there other bubbles that are like exciting to you right now? You mentioned the electrification or batteryization or whatever you're calling it. What else is on that list?
Definitely electrification is a huge one. Again, moving from, you know, from ICE or internal combustion to electric motors and systems. And I'll jump from that one to another industry that's changing a lot, which is if you look at aircraft and transport, we're definitely, I've invested in more than one autonomous aircraft company.
How interesting.
And you're like, well, how do those two fit together? A lot of what happened with autonomous aircraft was the intersection of massive increases in sensory and sort of local compute capacity. You know, for anything to be autonomous, it has to think and it has to sense. Mm-hmm. And over the last few years, again, I think we talked about this a little earlier, camera technology and then the software stack behind it has changed fundamentally, right? Our sensor capability has gone up and the cost of that sensing capability has come down. Imagine what you can buy and put on your bench today right now in terms of, you know, camera sensors, LiDAR, infrared, UWB or ultra wideband. I can hit any part of the radio spectrum at a much lower cost.
Right. Without having a ham license, right? You don't have to like make your own antennas anymore and all the other stuff where it was all custom previously and now it's off the shelf modules or chips or whatever you need.
Exactly. And the software behind it, like I can, you know, I don't have to write my own mesh library to get 5 or 10, you know, 900 megahertz nodes to talk to each other.
Right.
So sensing, communications, and compute, we've had such big advances on that, that now we can talk about, you know, adding limited or focused autonomy to things. And at the same time, that's this electrification push opened up low-cost motors. I think 5 years ago, if you wanted a motor of the capability that, you know, gives a Tesla the torque it has, try to buy one of those, let alone source it, right? That used to be esoteric.
Go wind your own windings. So you gotta
and you literally, you had to find a vendor who could consistently wind a motor of that capability. And you had to marry it manually with an ESC controller and you know, an ESC and then try to make sure you don't blow the motor or blow the board. Mm-hmm. Yep. Now those are off the shelf parts. So all of a sudden, if I'm building a drone that could fly, you know, for, you know, an hour and carry 100 kilo payload, what was impossible just maybe 5-7 years ago, now you see examples like I have a company, Elroy Air, that is looking at autonomous air cargo delivery, both for military and commercial applications. They started purely electric. What you realize is we do hit the edge of certain things like battery technology.
Yeah.
And you end up in hybrids where you use, you know, oftentimes you'll use a gas engine to power the electrical subsystems and to keep the batteries in a good charge state. But, you know, vertical takeoff and landing aircraft that are capable of autonomously delivering cargo, you know, a couple hundred kilos over 100 kilometer distance is now truly possible. We do it. And that was something we couldn't do years ago. And so the implications, as an example, for people in remote areas, like in Alaska, I'll just take Alaska or, you know, Northern Canada, they rely on manned air flight to get basic supplies.
Right. Yep.
Right. And so all of a sudden, if we could do that autonomously, unfortunately, you know, bush pilots occasionally die. It's a rough job. Weather conditions can change a lot. I would much rather crash an autonomous, you know, cargo craft than lose a bush pilot.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
And we can do that. We're building that type of technology. The military looks at it the same way. Unfortunately, if we have to go to war, I don't want to lose a pilot when I'm trying to deliver cargo or anything. So I think transportation, whether it's wheeled or treaded or in the air, it's fundamental. I'm personally an investor in Zipline, right? It's a company using drones to basically bypass ground infrastructure and fly medical supplies from point to point.
Oh, I've seen, that's the one where the plane gets there and it like lands in like, it's got like a wire catch, like on an aircraft carrier, right?
It goes into the equivalent of like a net, or it gets captured and it's slung out and then it uses the motor to fly. So it's like the catapult of an aircraft carrier. And then in flight, it's a winged craft and it just efficiently approaches the target, and then they catch it on the other side and reuse it. But, you know, it was originally started in Africa in situations where, unfortunately, due to civil war and a lack of sometimes just a lack of infrastructure investment, it's hard to get, you know, medical supplies quickly from point A to point B, but the air is wide open. And if you do it autonomously, if something, again, if something happens and the mission fails, you just, you know, launch another one. You're not unfortunately dealing with a loss of human life. So these are the sort of things that I think are again, if you told me we could do this 10 years ago when I started in the business, I would have been like, nope, we don't have the battery tech. We don't have the motor tech. We don't have the vision. We don't have the mission planning software. We don't have all these things. And now 10 years later, we're doing it.
Right. I think that's the crazy thing about it is like, no, this is a real thing. Like you could get a package dropped by an autonomous, you know, drone onto your doorstep. I mean, well, maybe not in a city, not in downtown Chicago, but like if you were in a rural area or in Africa somewhere, this is a real thing.
It absolutely is. And in fact, you know, another one of my investments was a company called Marble. And they were doing, a few years ago, they were doing, you know, point to point remote delivery, you know, like you could put food, groceries, anything in a robot that just rolled up and down the sidewalks. From a technology perspective, we were there, but then we quickly found out, you know, like the city of San Francisco was like, there are no rules about this. We didn't know there were no rules about it, but now there's a rule. You can't do it.
Yeah, right.
And so sometimes we race in front of the rest of society, and we almost have to wait for regulations and best practices to come into play. To your point, we can point-to-point drone delivery things today, but you know the FAA's got to figure out, well, how would I regulate the airspace when that many objects are simultaneously below 300 feet?
Yeah.
Right.
Yep.
We built an entire system to manage, you know, anything from 1,000 to 38,000 feet. But underneath it, you know, we had some loose regulations because there was no technology to really flood that area.
It's like the Gibson quote about future's already here. It's just not evenly distributed kind of thing, right?
And exactly.
In that gradient, somewhere there needs to be regulation so that someone doesn't get bonked in the head by a drone or bonked in the shin by a drone or whatever might be capable.
I always love to tell the story when we were looking at Marble. We went and pulled all the regulations for major metros about what could and couldn't be on a sidewalk. And the closest thing we could find that was regulated was hot dog stands, food vendors. Because it was, you know, sidewalks were for people and dogs at best, right? And you know, the only rule is don't let your dog pee or poo on there. And, you know, if you're a food vendor, here are your rules. But no one, you know, they hadn't been reading their science fiction. They didn't realize we were going to have a robot go up and down the sidewalk. And so there were no regulations. And so part of what we had to do as a company was to work with local regulators to try to figure out how to make rules.
Sure, sure. Well, you know, you really missed an opportunity. You throw one of those hot dog heaters on the top and boom, you're done. You've already matched your regulations. It just happens to also have storage where you're spewing your packages out of it. Have a hot dog for free. And also there's delivery as a side service.
A hot dog and your groceries.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Oh boy, just sloshing hot dog water all over the sidewalk. It's really not a pretty picture. So what is the story of then? So like a company like that, are they just kind of in limbo right now as regulations kind of catch up?
Well, two things. Number one, they have to spend time working with local communities to help create those rules. And so across that industry, there are other companies like Starship and Robbie and others who were also founded around the same time frame. You know, some of them retreated and said, well, okay, if there are regulations about streets, where else could I go from point A to point B? And I'll give you two other examples, right? So on a college campus, all the sidewalks are owned by the university. All of a sudden you have one regulatory body and you say, well, wouldn't you like to be able to move supplies or books or food to dorms from places without having cars all over your campus? And they're like, oh, I sort of like that. Mm-hmm. So I think Starship went and did a lot of university deliveries. And then if you think about a large industrial factory, right, multiple buildings on a larger site, you're moving WIP between buildings all the time, right?
Yep.
Work in progress, right? I got to move, here's a half weld, you know, I got a weld on it, but I haven't done finishing. Move it over to the next place.
Right. And you might build in that infrastructure. Like I was in a fab and there were, you know, these movers that do this thing automatically. But if you're not investing in that infrastructure, you might want to have like a quote unquote off the shelf thing, like a Marble or Starship doing that kind of thing, right?
Absolutely. And again, you're always moving things around. If you think about logistics is exploding right now, and Amazon, Prologis, anyone, DHL, FedEx, anyone who's got a huge number of packages, they're always just moving them around. That's their job, is to move.
That's right.
So they need things that can move five feet, and they need things that can move 500 miles. And so they're investing heavily in transportation robotic solutions for all different scenarios.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, past guest of the show, Greg Charvat, he works on Humatics, and that's indoor tracking for third-party robots that are doing that kind of thing, when you need to track where a robot might be in a factory or something like that.
Oh, heck of hard. That's another great example. 5 and 10 years ago, how did you, without GPS, how did you track something inside of a building? Well, it was a lot of custom radio and a lot of finger crossing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and there's multipath and all the RF craziness that happens there. And
building full of metal and maybe fluid.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yuck.
Right.
So yeah, that's another thing that, you know, with a bunch of technologies and hybrids, fusions of different technologies, all of a sudden we can track things inside a buildings with a degree of accuracy. I've seen amazing stuff at 6 gigahertz, looking at examples where we can look through walls and the applications of that, like in elder care, no one wants to get tagged and bagged, right? No one wants to wear a tag that, you know, they always know where I am and I don't like it. I wouldn't want it. But but at the same time, if you fall and I need to know if I run a hospital or a nursing home, but how do I sense without having to be intrusive on a patient or on an individual? We're inventing that tech now. So again, this is that cycle. We invent a new technology and you've got to figure out how to change the world with it, but, you know, not be too far over your skis, not too far in front of what the technology can do or the market is ready for. And then also, you know, not be too far behind.
Mm, okay. Well, that's great. And actually I always like to ask when people are in VC, you know, we have a lot of engineers listening, like you alluded to, that might be thinking about getting into the, you know, the entrepreneurial space, either pairing up with someone on the business side or trying it themselves. What is something when you're looking at an investment or you're looking at a new space like this, what do you like to see when people are approaching you with, you know, in terms of the technology, but then also the presentation to someone like you, so that you will actually consider it?
Yeah, I am. As you said earlier, the thing that we invest in first and foremost as venture capitalists is people. If I invest in your company, I'm going to be working with you hopefully 5, 10, 15 years, right? Yeah, as your company grows from 2 people to 2,000.
Yeah. So you heard it here first, folks. Stop finishing your product and go to finishing school.
I gave a presentation to a bunch of entrepreneurs who were in Autodesk's residency program yesterday.
Oh,
and
yeah,
I said,
yeah,
the thing that you didn't go to study in college that's going to surprise you that you need now is storytelling. I always say that, you know, I always put up a slide. It has a picture of Steve Jobs holding up an iPhone. And I said his superpower at some level was storytelling.
Sure. Yeah. You got to create a vision that people believe in, right?
I mean, I went to work there in 1991, I think I was an intern in 1990. And I was like the Pied Piper. I was like a kid out of, you know, still in school going, I hear a sound and I must be there. Right. It was the allure of California and this, you know, the Apple computer that I worked on, you know, while I was in class and after school and stuff. He was a storyteller. And so bringing this back, you can be the greatest mechatronics engineer or EE or ME, but what you're creating is a team. You as an individual need to put the assets around you that can build a company. And so when I think about a hardware company, I think about 3 or 4 components. I always think, all right, who's in charge of the hardware? Who's in charge of the software? Who's in charge of the business? And who is that charismatic outbound person who can put it all together and make it a story? Because early on investments, we call it dream and team, right? Mm-hmm. Early on in a pre-seed or a seed investment, the earliest rounds of funding, you may have a proof of concept, right? It's the bubble gum and rubber bands and a dev board,
right? Yeah.
Right. And it barely works, but it points to a future. There's a story that wraps around your first prototype. It's a vision. It's a belief. Your ability to communicate that is everything.
Yeah.
But we didn't go to school. Like when I was sitting in the, CS department writing, gleefully writing code on a Sun workstation, I wasn't thinking, wow, I should get over to the English department and study effective communication skills. Right, I was like, right. My code's got to be 5% more efficient.
Right.
Then you come out and become an entrepreneur and you realize a big part of your job is a storyteller. You have to convince people to come and join your organization. You have to convince people to invest in it. You have to convince suppliers to do unnatural acts, right? To
give you credit.
to give you credit, to sign an MSA, right? To actually agree to pick up your little product on their factory line versus a bigger contract.
Yep.
All of that is communication. And so,
Eric, this is very frustrating, I have to say.
Oh, as someone no. wants to
similar well, no, I mean it's your I get it. Like you're totally right. It's just like, man, the more I hear it, the more I'm like, yeah, damn. Like, yep. But I think that is a good thing to hear up front, right? It's like because the expectation is there, maybe someone who's listening is like, you like technology, stay in this technology space, right? It's like entrepreneurship is its separate thing. And so we had John Saunders on here who's NYC CNC, and he talked about like the hardware versus the entrepreneurship thing, and he kind of melded it in that he made a company that was also making hardware, but it was like it's basically on the services side. But it's like if you're making a thing, then like you're talking about, you have to get people to help you make that thing, and there's so many elements around it that aren't just the what's inside of the thing.
You've just, and again, I'll bring it back. This is why hardware is hard. You've got to have somebody to run the business, to sell it. By the way, you want to talk about a polar opposite creature than a lot of engineers is the sales guy.
Oh, right? Yeah.
And I've watched entrepreneurs flail trying to figure out how to hire a salesperson because they don't know how to interview them. They're like, I've never been a salesperson. I don't understand anything about what they do. And, I used to besmirch the sales guy and now I need one. And you're like,
right.
Oh, now you understand, their superpower, right? And
yeah.
So hardware is about bringing together all these disparate disciplines into a cohesive team. So when I go back and answer your question about a founder, I'm looking typically for 2 to 3 founders because it's really hard to have the charismatic, super amazing mechatronics engineer who also was a sales guy, right? Or a saleswoman, right? It just, it's a mythical creature. Mm-hmm. So you typically, when you're thinking about starting a company, you're like, okay, who are, 1, 2, or 3 people who can join me as either founders or early employees who are the yin to my yang, the chocolate to my peanut butter, right? That create a team. And that's what we invest in is that small team. And you may not have every piece of it. Like I can help. I often will say, oh, you guys are wonderful, but you need to meet Eileen over here because Eileen, her mechatronic skills are amazing and you've got the idea or you understand how to sell to cat dealers.
Right.
And you guys should make a heavy robot right there, right? You guys are the perfect, team. But it is that part of it that I look for more than the technology. By far, I always tell entrepreneurs, the vast majority of the time I say no, it's not because I didn't believe in their technology or the market. It's that I didn't see the right team to persevere through what's going to be a really hard journey.
Right. Yep. Oh, boy. So then you go to somewhere like a Pier 9 and you're giving a talk to Autodesk folks and something like that. And it's a bunch of technical nerds like me
brethren, let's come together.
Right. Yes, exactly. Right, let's kumbaya, and also here's how we make it happen. So where do you source the storyteller, management, salesy types and actually get along with them, like
you just said two separate things, right?
Well I know, but I was really getting at, I don't think most of them are listening, so I'm cool with that. But like, is it an MBA program? Is it is it just someone who naturally is already in a sales position? Like what is the you know, so if someone is listening to this, they love the technology, they want to push their thing out in the world, they know they need that person, where do they go and seek them out?
Yeah, I think that I'll give you answers that are sort of relative to where you are in the world. I think at university, the great thing is you can leave the engineering building and wander over to the business building, right? And that's, you know, that's a stereotype that those two folks aren't all, you know, we don't have crossover folks all the time.
Right, but, right. Yeah.
Or, hey, if you're in engineering school and you're like, hey, I think I'm going to be an entrepreneur someday. I feel like that's my path. I would start taking classes, like take your electives in the business school, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Drop the photography class and head to the business school, or by the way, go over and go to the comms building, right? And pick up some comms classes.
Or theater. I mean, theater helps too.
Theater helps. All of it does. And, or go get your MBA after your technical degree, right? And make yourself your own peanut butter and chocolate, right? Go ahead and if you think you have that proclivity, that desire to do that, then train up knowing that it's not just technical prowess. I can show you so many technical founders who woke up one morning, they're like, man, one day I was writing code and the next day I didn't get to write. I don't do anything technical because now I'm the CEO and I have to deal with HR and legal and fundraising. And man, I used to be a really good mechanical engineer. What happened to me? Right. I'm like, what happened was is you became an entrepreneur, right? You have to become a leader and a multidisciplinarian. That's the definition of an entrepreneur.
Right.
I do career development once I bring my founders in. And one question I ask them is, I call it cell division. It's as your company is growing, you're trying to get someone smarter than you in every other job function that needs to get filled. But as the founder, you get to ask yourself a simple question. When it's all said and done, what job do I want to do? I'm the owner of the company. I should make that decision. Mm-hmm. And I say to them, look, if you love technology, if at midnight you're in front of an IDE, or if you're sitting there in Eagle or, you know, Altium or wherever you are, and that's your love.
Around here, we do KiCad, Eric, but it's cool.
I know you do. I was just trying to see if I could rib you there.
You got me. You got me. Damn it. Bait taken.
If you're in the tool of your choice.
All right. That's
fair. And that's your love, then do that. Stay in IC and you'll always be a founder. If you love looking at the strategy of technology, be the VP of engineering or be the CTO. Mm-hmm. But an entrepreneur, like, you end up having to be a great communicator. You have to understand a balance sheet. Yeah. And you got to be prepared to fly to Shenzhen and negotiate.
Yeah. Drink, have a couple drinks and get to know your new teammates from.
So in university, you have other disciplines represented by schools. When you go out into the work world, the thing I always say, let's say you're working for Caterpillar. By the way, you know, if you're in engineering, there's a business group over there. Go meet them. Go talk to them. Go network, because someone over there may be thinking of an idea and you're like, boy, I could build that in a heartbeat. And you know, network in your professional community as you leave university, because it's the same thing. Someone is cross-training too, or their functional discipline is the one you're missing.
Yeah.
And so I think in the hardware community, we try to create happy hours and things to bring them together. It's hard to convince some of the business folks to come to our hardware happy hours, because they're like, it's a bunch of nerds staring.
They're going to show off their prototypes. I just know where this is going to go.
I mean, I love bringing my prototypes to it, but you know, I think we do try to create it. And as a venture capitalist, that's part of my job is to go, oh, hey, I know the greatest business person you don't know, or the head of manufacturing that, you know, you haven't, or salespeople, I can augment that. But as you're doing it before you get to talk to VCs or anything, I think it's really, again, it's networking. It comes back to that thing we said, like the thing we're having trouble doing in a coronavirus world.
You gotta talk
world.
To people. Oh man.
You do. Again, as much as I love sitting at my bench, you know, I guess that's, you know, the thing is you gotta networking and interacting with people. That's a big part of being an entrepreneur.
Yeah. Yeah. I just recently signed up for Lunch Club. Have you heard about that?
No. Tell me more.
So Lunch Club is lunchclub.ai, and I'll send a link because I think I get like some points if I do that, but I'll have a link in the show notes. But it's basically, it's just a pairing. You basically say, hey, I'm technical. I want to meet someone in either a similar technical field or whatever, and they try and pair you up. And it's a cool idea. It's basically, and then you like get on like a, you know, Zoom call or a Jitsi meet or similar, and you just chat for an hour. It's basically,
oh, that's awesome.
It's speed dating for nerds. I mean, it could be founders, but it doesn't have to be. And so I met two people so far in Chicago, and I'm going to keep trying it. So I like it so far.
No, I think it's super important. That's what I love is when I get to get on the road, whether I'm in, you know, Denver or Cleveland or Boston or whatever, it's just meeting other entrepreneurs, other engineers, mm-hmm. because in that I can go, holy cow. Like I remember years ago, I met Kip Bradford, this, you know, polyglot. Kip's the greatest. And I could talk with Kip for hours, but if I hadn't gotten off my butt and left my little lab, I wouldn't have met the awesomeness of Kip. Right. And, mm-hmm. and now when I have questions about refrigeration or about nine other things, mm-hmm. I just call Kip. I'm like, Kip, what do I do? Who do you, you know, and it's that networking that small businesses you thrive because you can't solve every problem yourself. You need friends, right? Yeah. I don't understand why my radios are conflicting. Like, okay, you know, there aren't many RF engineers. You better know someone who knows one because there aren't that many of them.
Right. Make friends or be prepared to pay a couple $100 an hour to buy their time.
Exactly. So again, I just keep always coming back to that. You know, companies are about people, and entrepreneurs are they're their glue. They're the center point of the whole thing.
Yeah. Well, let's hear some more about the companies that you have invested. I mean, so this is a long list. People can go to lemnos.vc/companies and, you know, all of your companies are listed there. Are there others on this that we haven't talked about yet? So we've talked about Electrify and Elroy Air, but what about like Camp 6 or Drop Labs or Dishcraft? What are some of these other ones doing that are interesting and exciting?
Yeah, like I'll give you a great example is Dishcraft. Have you ever washed dishes?
I have.
It's something a lot of us have done. It's not necessarily the funnest job. And then I always ask the second question, have you ever washed dishes in a restaurant?
I have actually. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, is that the job and path of your life that you,
Oh no, it was not a long-term thing, but I actually liked it 'cause you got to control the radio. That was always the thing for me. So I worked at a frozen custard place and I got to like control the radio and I was back there for like 2 or 3 hours a night and just kind of like, you know, you were the last one to leave, unfortunately, but I did like the radio part. I will be honest about that.
It's a job today. If you look another, I often happen to look at macro trends, minus the politics of the universe, migrant labor coming into the United States, which by the way, powers so much of what we do. Yeah. It peaked around 2010.
Oh, really?
And so there are less people coming into the United States and entry-level jobs for folks who are maybe still learning the language, going to night school and all those things, they're harder to come by. One of them, a big one, is backside of the restaurant. Everything that you as a restaurant goer don't see. And one of the hardest jobs in there is dishwashing. Mm-hmm. It's a hot, humid environment. Remember that water is heated up to 100, 125. I think it's 125, 140. The mm-hmm. machines are hot. It's damp. It's of course it's just food waste and it's not a job most people aspire to make a career out of.
Yeah.
And with migrant labor sort of peaked out, the problem for restaurant people is they pay they often pay their dishwashing staff almost the same rate that they pay a sous chef. So
really?
Like over $27 an hour. And those people, they just burn out because it's a crappy job. Mm-hmm. So Dishcraft looked at this. Linda, the CEO, who was one of the original founders of not iRobot, the other robot vacuum company. It's eluding me.
I got a Roomba at home, so I'm sorry.
I know. Scott Miller, we love you.
Yeah.
but she was a experienced robotics founder and she looked at this problem and said, hey, can't we automate this? Right. So if you've worked in the back end, you know that there's this big dishwashing machine called a Hobart, right? Mm. And it sits back there and you have to get the dishes that come in sort of haphazardly. You got to separate them into there. Is it a spoon, a fork, a cup, a glass? You got to rack them. You got to pre-wash them and then you got to run them through the Hobart. And on the backside, you got to do the whole thing in reverse, right? You got to resort it back out and get it recirculating because restaurants spend all their time thinking about plate counts, which is just how many times in an evening can they turn a table? Hmm. And so what you're thinking about is throughput. And if your dishwasher walks out or they don't show up one day because they're just tired of it or they're hurting and aching, all of a sudden you don't have throughput. You can't serve, you know, you right. don't have the plates to serve. You bottleneck and you break down. And so Linda looked at this and said, well, couldn't we automate this? Isn't it time? And you're like, oh, that's got to be an easy robotics problem to solve.
No, well, oh, God, no.
Oh, no, gosh, no. Like sorting, like, okay, you know, someone brings in a big bucket full of stuff. You've not only got to figure out what's in the bucket, but you've got to be able to figure out how to grip a spoon versus a plate.
I was just imagining a robot arm just crashing through a stack of plates, you know, like when there's no sensing, like feedback, it's like, it's just a lot of cracked porcelain or ceramic rather.
So we funded her to tackle the problem. And now she can, with incredibly high throughput, wash dishes for restaurants and they looked at different business models and now they do it as a service. So literally people send the dirty dishes over and they turn around and truck back out clean ones in the same way linen gets cleaned.
Oh, interesting. Does that mean that they need more plates up front, but then the company like fronts them that stack of plates?
Yeah. In essence, you're guaranteed to have every business day the number of, you know, plates and silverware and serviceware that you need. And at the end of the day, you send it out. But no matter what, the next morning, you always have what you need.
Yeah.
That's the way linen works. Like, again, no one, you know, restaurants don't keep... It's diapers. Exactly. Yeah. But the problem on the back end is, you know, if, you know, you could either hire, you know, hundreds of dishwashers, which think of I'll give you a great example. In Las Vegas, if you think about all the restaurants, right? Mm-hmm. Think about at a large casino, they serve 10,000 plates or, you know, plated meals a day for the staff. Not even. Yes. So in the back end, you never saw that. 10,000 place settings had to go through on a day just to feed everybody. Not even the front end staff. Right, not you as the
guest. That's your break even. Yeah.
And so you the scale of that problem. Think of airlines. When an airplane lands, how much dishware has to come off and come on? There's all these great hotels. A convention center. So she went after what, you know, when I, as a venture capitalist, I'm like, wow, that's a huge problem. And as a technologist, I'm like, how are you going to do that? And we thought of all these different ways of gripping and capturing plates and sorting it. And she hired a world-class group of folks from SRI and they solved it. And so that's a great example of a company that is using, you know, applied robotics to solve one particular problem that, again, 10 years ago, I don't think we could have economically done it. But now she can offer something where it's cheaper for a company to engage her service to deal with the dishware rather than keeping all that equipment and staff on site. That also that savings, restaurateurs, they're going to probably put some in their pocket, which thank gosh, we need them to do that right now.
Yeah, right now, condition. Right, of course. Yeah.
But a restaurateur always says, if I have a dollar to spend, I'm going to try to put as much of it in the front end experience, what the customer experience is. So anytime you can save the money, they can be a more profitable business, but they can also invest in you, the customer.
Right.
And so that's how we look at these problems. So it's exciting because I get to understand the technology of the solving the problem, but I had to try to work, you know, with Linda and the team to look at the business of dishes. Because again, she could solve the problem, but if we didn't do it from a business perspective in a way that was profitable both for her and for her customers, then the technology didn't matter.
Yeah. So like a company like that too, I mean, and just speaking more broadly, like, when they go into a customer and they, you know, they're trying to price out their product, like a dish service or something like that, I guess they're not selling the robot directly. So it might be a little bit easier on like a service basis, right? They're saying like, oh, well, it's, you know, price per plate or price per month or something like that. But if there is maybe other companies that you invest in, like what is the maximum payout time that companies could charge, right? So if like, hey, you're paying 30 grand a year to a dishwasher, our device costs 120 grand. So it's a 4-year payoff or something like that. Like what does that math look like if there is a hardware element in it?
Yeah, there's two sides of that equation. I'll say that one of the things that, and we'll stay in robotics for a minute. In applied robotics, there are some companies who want to treat the robot's purchase as a capital expenditure, right? They buy it. They want to write you a check and own the robot.
Right.
Yep. Right. Think of Ford Motor Company, all those big arms that are moving F-150 yep. parts around.
ABB
Ford
and KUKA. And, yep. Yep.
I'm pretty sure Ford owns those things, right? They have the capital budget to do it. Then you turn around and there are some businesses like a restaurant that are more cash driven, cash in, cash out. And so what they want to do is spend OPEX money or you know, cash in, cash out. They don't want to spend $10,000, but they'll gladly give you $1,000 a month.
Right. Yep.
And so one of the things, venture capitalists love reoccurring revenue businesses, right?
Right.
Because they yeah. love SaaS, SaaS.
Which is software as a service for
software
people.
Software as a service,
and,
yes.
And when Scott Miller, who Eric mentioned earlier, was on recently, he was talking about product as a service as another newer thing, but that's...
I always say you can put anything in front of an ass, which is robots as a service, product right, as a service, right. flight as a service, thrust right. as a service, GE, you know, famously will sell you thrust as a service. Everything's been made into it as a service, but venture almost over-indexes on your ability to do that. Whereas I always say, you know, if somebody wants to write me a $500,000 check for a robot, I'm going to, as a business owner, I'm going to take it, you know, you're as a service be damned. Right. But underneath,
I'll sell you a service contract in addition to it, but also I'll take the big check of money up front.
Exactly. So I think there's a natural conflict where a lot of businesses are used to paying for, some businesses are used to paying for things up front. And when we try to sell it to them as a service, they're like, no, I want to buy that robot. And the venture capitalists say, no, I only want them to take it as a service. And I'm like, no, you're a business owner. You're going to take the cash however you can get your hands on it.
Right, stick it in a savings account. Every month you get some money out and there's your as a service.
Exactly. But again, a big part of when you're a startup, your job early on and a lot of the initial money that I put into a company is to do two things. This is what the seed, what we call in the venture business, the seed round is for. It's to prove primary product market fit and to reduce technical risk, to prove that I can take that there's a customer that wants to buy it at the price that we think we can sell it for. That's primary product risk, just proving that. And then the second part is, can we build it and manufacture it at the price that the customer need that will match right. the economics? And if during the seed phase, if we can prove those two things, that means we're ready to ramp the business up. So when I give money to a company, part of what that entrepreneur is doing is going in and doing customer interviews and saying, hey, restaurant, if I could make a thing that would wash your dishes, how would you pay for it? And how much would you pay? And how much do you pay how much do you spend currently? And then you go back and you look at it and go, well, they spend $1. Could I give it to them for 50 cents? Because if it's 90 cents, they're going to go, why do I have to incur the switching cost? Right.
That's right. Yep. Yep.
You know, we all know, like when you change, like I'm changing development environments right now, super painful, right? Mm-hmm. Switching cost. Yep. And so you have to provide so much benefit that it overwhelms the switching costs. And so that process early on is what entrepreneurs have to learn how to do. And that's a lot of both primary customer interviews and then a lot of research. You spend a lot of time reading papers about businesses and understanding, again, how much is a single dish to wash? I had to go learn that. So that we could look at this particular business. And so, yeah, there's a lot of research that goes on to say, oh, in this business, 30% of the people do CapEx, 60% do OpEx, you know, and how would I build a variable pricing model? How could I sell some people want to buy it, some people want to rent it as a service. How do I build a business around that?
Yeah. And is that something that you expect? So again, to go back to what you expect and what you kind of hope for when someone approaches you, is that something that you'd want to see presented to you as a, you know, hey, here's the reality of the financial situation?
Oh, I mean, idyllically, and again, in the land of magical unicorns, you know, someone walks in with the perfect business plan and a well-developed prototype with a clean manufacturing plan. And I'm like, wow, I don't feel like there's any risk.
You're probably like, am I getting punked?
Exactly. That would be the VC equivalent of getting punked. In reality, what I'm almost more evaluating is their logic, like how they would attack the problem. I love it when an entrepreneur comes to me and says, I know this and this, but I don't know the answer to this. Here's how I might try to solve it. Because they may or be right or wrong, but number one, they're honest.
Yeah. Yeah.
They have humility and we can have a dialogue, because then I can engage and say, okay, you don't know the answer to this, but maybe I know the person who does. And we can help that person. We can bring that person in to help you solve that. But it is really an assessment, like any great problem, of, you know, what do we know? What do we not know? And how would we remove the fog of war to the best of our ability? An entrepreneur that comes in who's just cocky, who says, I know the answer to every question, and I'm feeling it. I'm like, you have a power I don't have, because whenever I stare at new things, I'm like, oh boy, I don't know.
Right, right.
And so you're looking almost for problem solving capability more than the answer to every problem, because you run a business. There are days you wake up and you're just like, well, that's a new one. I haven't seen that yet.
Yeah, it's been happening more than I like lately, but yes, yeah, it does happen.
And it's how you approach that is it forges the mettle of an entrepreneur, which is, you know, how do I solve problems? Because I'm going to see new ones every day.
Yeah.
I always say that for me, like my job as a VC is to communicate and impart wisdom and knowledge, because I've been building hardware for 20 something years. It's not a badge of honor. It just means I have a lot of scar tissue. And if I can help you not make the mistakes that I and others like us made, you can make a new spectacular mistake that none of us have ever thought of before, right, which the solution to maybe creates an amazing breakthrough.
Right. Eric is like the robot that makes the weld over. It tells you about the weld that has happened over and over again. So you can go make that new weld, which is that new huge mistake.
I mean, that's what we all do, right? You're yeah. able to look at things and tell people, oh, hey, did you think of this? Right. It's the 10,000 hours, you know, behind the stick. That's our greatest advantage. And if you can accumulate enough people around you of various disciplines with that flight time, then you have the best chance you have of creating a company. That's all it is. It's not ego. It's scar tissue.
Yep. Definitely. Well, and people can hear more about your scar tissue because you have a podcast. You've done 3 seasons of the Lemnos Into the Forge. Can you tell us about that real quick?
Yeah, over the years, I ended up becoming a hardware guy. I started in software and drifted into hardware. And then I ended up becoming an angel investor and a VC. And when people asked me about that journey, I was like, well, you know, the thing I realized is that there are no rules. Like if you want to do something, you just got to go and learn and do it. And I realized that there was no one path to being a founder, right? We glorify the MIT, you know, super graduate with the 1600 SAT score. Now I don't even know what number it is.
Actually, I think they're getting rid of that now. Aren't they saying, yay, like, aren't schools going away from it?
Yes, I'm appreciative of that. But you know, we glorify the perfect, quote unquote, the perfect path, right? The amazing student who, you know, went to the perfect college and then went to the perfect company and became an entrepreneur. I can tell you without a doubt, with massive statistics to prove it, founders come from every walk of life.
Yep.
And what I wanted to do with the podcast was capture those stories so that when someone's thinking, I've got a great idea, I think I might be able to do it, I didn't want them to be dissuaded, because when they looked at themselves in the mirror, they don't see the rat on the ring, aka the MIT degree. They're like, am I a founder? And so when you listen to 10 different founders, you're going to hear 10 different stories of people who didn't work on hardware until they started a company. Right.
Yeah.
Or people who grew up like me, you know, sort of, you know, I had a chance between to buy a dirt bike or a TI-99/4A. And, you know, you probably guess which one I bought. Right. Those stories, though, I created this podcast so that other founders or people thinking about the path to creating a company could hear not only that backgrounds are very diverse, but to hear the stories of real founders, not the glossy, it's wonderful, you get kombucha in the morning and it's all wonderful and money rains from the sky, but to hear, you know, what are the hard parts of it? What are the things you have to grow into? What are the challenges? And how do you grow as an individual? So I created a podcast just to interview founders, not about their companies and their product, but about their journey.
Yep. That's great. And I think that's good too. I've been asking what people listening here can go and be interested, you know, and how they can approach you and approach the entrepreneurial process. But it sounds like it's just, you know, just as easy to listen to how other people did it and model behavior off of their experience and their scar tissue, like you talked about.
No, we all have, as entrepreneurs, we all have a story, and I love those stories more than anything else, because I find them inspiring. Because again, it's not an easy path. Like my wife always, whenever I end a job, because I've you know, built a bunch of companies and some failures, some successes, at the end of it, she always goes, "Why do you keep doing hardware? Like, it's just, it's crazy." And of course, my wife works for hardware companies most of the time. Well, so it's ironic. Learned? And I'm like, I don't know. I'm like I'm a moth to a flame. When I'm done at the end of the day, I run to my bench and make some goofy prototype of something. That's just who I am. But inside of it, you know, inside of the difficulty, it's why do we aspire to do it? What inspires us to do this? Those stories, that's candy for me. And so I wanted to give other entrepreneurs that. And it goes to the thing, you know, for the, you know, listeners in this audience and across the board, people always say, well, how do, oh my gosh, you're a VC. I don't know how to get a hold of you. VCs never return calls or anything. It comes back to networking. I started in engineering. I'm staring at my bench right now. It never hurts to ask. I have found the one thing I love about hardware is that we're a smaller community. And I have always found that if I pick up the phone and call a peer and I go, hey, I'm stuck on this, or I need this, we just take care of each other because we know how hard it is, the thing we're doing. So never be afraid to network. And I think you create this podcast, I have a podcast. We're all trying to, you know, increase the collective intelligence of our small community, but always network, because hardware folks are just, they're nicer, I think, at the end of the day.
Yeah. We just want to show our prototypes and talk about cool, weird stuff. You know, like that's all coming.
That's our dream, right? Is to go to SuperCon and just go, look at this. And you're like, whoa,
yeah, that's awesome. So many LEDs.
This is my greatest fear this year is I've been working every year. I started going to SuperCon a few years ago. I was late to the party. And every year I go, God, I got to focus. So this year I'm like, I'm bringing this cool thing that I've been working on for a while. And I'm like, please don't have it be canceled this year. I'm finally ready to bring my goodies. Yeah, so.
Yeah. I've been pushing the supply frame, folks. I'm like, hey, look, it's November. We're going to be fine. A lot of stuff got canceled. Okay. Summer's out, but like, come on, November, we're going to be fine by November. You gotta do it.
I'll wear a mask, but we got to go. Yeah, but it's that networking. Right. Again, I come back to it because it's take pride in your barely working prototype that's going to crash when you try to demo it to somebody, and know that being a hardware entrepreneur is hard. And I always tell stories and people are like, are you just trying to scare me off? I'm like, no, what I'm trying to do is tell you, if you're a ship and you're in a harbor and it's got some mines in it, wouldn't you like to know where the mines are so that you could sail around them and get out into the open ocean? If you knew that, that's where folks like you and Scott Miller and me and any others who've had some time in the water, it's our job to help you get around those things so that you can be successful. Cause that's awesome.
Yeah. Totally. I will put a pitch in as well for we are doing virtual hardware happy hours right now. I don't know if you've heard about those,
but I have.
San Francisco. Yeah, you've been to San Francisco one, hopefully.
I've sponsored and been to the ones. And in fact, I would have to give you the link, but I think maybe it was Supply Frame. Somebody created a master list of all the hardware events that are going on, a calendar. Nice. And the Chicago one appears on the calendar.
Oh, great.
It's this great feed where somebody was just accumulating all the virtual stuff that's going on right now in the hardware space. And I was like, oh my gosh, my calendar's full. I feel so, so enabled.
I think it's great too. Like you mentioned, you have, you know, hardware on your bench and talking about SuperCon and stuff like that. I really like that as like a motivating force to like get some stuff done because you want to show it off there or get feedback on it too. That's the important thing is like, you know, maybe if you're stuck on something you could show, I think showing half finished prototypes is as valuable or more valuable than the finished thing, just because it's like, someone's going to be like, well, why'd you do that? And then you explain it and, you know, you kind of go back and forth about what's going on with it. And that can really build camaraderie, but also like help you get free advice and answers and brainstorming. You know, that's awesome.
No, and I would really amplify that. I mean, the first year I went to SuperCon, you know, I have my own history, but when I went there the first year, I had a massive dose of imposter syndrome. I was like,
me too, every year.
Oh my gosh, the people there are so much smarter than me. I'm learning EE now. Like again, I'm pretty good with software, and I'm sort of learning. I'm not bad with mechanical, but EE is a new art to me and I love it, but I go there and I'm just intimidated, and I have sort of half baked stuff. And you know, what is it? Perfect is the enemy of good. Don't, mm-hmm. when you go to share, I always, you know, I'm always terrified that people are going to look at it and laugh at it. And then I'm like, no, that's the thing. If you can get past that barrier of feeling like you shouldn't be in the room or that your thing mm-hmm. isn't good enough, that's never true. Like if it came from you and from your inspiration and your heart and your, you know, your ability, the people around you, I found it like SuperCon, they embrace it and are like, oh, did you think of this? And oh, we could do this. And mm-hmm. and then they, you know, they show you theirs and it falls over halfway through and you're like, oh, that's so cool, right?
yep.
But getting past imposter syndrome and the, you know, I don't want to share it if it's not perfect, I think is one of those things that if you can do it, then you can really, the community can embrace you and you can embrace the community, because none of us get it right the first time or the 100th time.
Mm-hmm. Yep. That's more true than I wish it was, but yes, it's very true. Yeah. I always like, I love when someone brings their first PCB to a meetup because they're like, oh, it's just this small little thing. And I'm like, that is amazing. Like the making that jump to making a first thing like that with a PCB is like so enabling. No one is surprised by me saying this, I'm sure, but like, I love when people bring it though, because it shows that they are like on the path and trying new things. Like I think that's just the number one thing that I want to celebrate when people are out at meetups and stuff.
Oh yeah. Like getting to Blinky. I mean, I'm on that journey right now. My first, I'm building stuff and I need a PCB that routes power to here, here, and here. And I'm like, all right, it's time for me to jump off the cliff. Right.
Yeah.
Don't call a friend, do it.
That's right. That's right.
But it's, you know, the first thing I'm sure I'm going to reach out, cause it's going to, as I learn, KiCad, it's going to be, it's, you know, I'm going to be in new territory. But again, that's as I bring it back to entrepreneurship, imagine that journey that you do with your functional discipline that you've gotten good at. As an entrepreneur, you end up having to do it across five or six different disciplines simultaneously.
Yeah. Right.
And that's being an entrepreneur, and the way that you know, learn and grow in it is to surround yourself with others, because you just can't learn fast enough across. It's too many fire spigots in your mouth at the same time.
That's right. Well, Eric, this has been a great conversation about entrepreneurship and the hardware companies you're investing in. Where can people find you and your stuff online?
Yeah, you can reach me over email. I'm just Eric, E-R-I-C, at Lemnos, LEMNOS.VC. Up on Twitter, I'm Circulio, SircoOlio. And I can barely, you know, you barely remember to spell your own handle.
Right. It
comes from back when I worked in video games.
Nice.
And again, I always say my mi casa es su casa. You know, send me an email, reach out to me. I'm always happy to chat. This is my passion in life, and I'm always happy to share any knowledge or connections or wisdom or anything that I can offer.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. And I'm looking forward to season 4 of Into the Forge and hearing more podcasts from you.
I am too. I'm excited to increase the audio quality. I'm not a bad interviewer, but I'm learning audio engineering as well. So
that's a new field to learn. Yeah.
Indeed.
All right. Well, thanks so much for joining today.
My pleasure.